Good day, and welcome to the Tips and Takeaways for Maintaining the Retirement Plan Document conference call. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Ms. Bonnie Trico. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Great. Well, welcome, everyone. Thank you to the webinar. Today, I'm so excited to be here with Summer and talking to you about plan documents, and hopefully we'll make the discussion about plan documents a little bit fun and also have some actionable takeaways for you. So it's great to do an audio cast because hopefully we'll make it a bit more interactive as opposed to, you know, a webinar where we're just kind of clicking and moving to the next slide. So again, thanks to Summer for joining me, and thank you for the efforts of the marketing department at Drinker Biddle and at our firm for putting today's presentation together. So I wanted to let everyone know that there will be a Q&A session at the end, so you can have some questions prepared at the end of the presentation. But with that, I think we'll go ahead and jump into the material. What we'll do is we're going to do some kind of basics at the beginning, so just talking about plan documents in general, and then we'll get into kind of talking through some of the issues that plan sponsors are facing and some of the common things that you spot when working through plan document issues. So I think, you know, Summer and I will kind of go back and forth, and then we'll have some takeaways. So I think if that works for you, Summer, if that works for you as well, that's how we'll kind of get started.
That sounds great. Let's go for it.
Perfect. So, you know, when we think about the basics of a plan document, what I want to start with are just some of the common terms. And one of the things in our industry that I think happens is that we start to use terms interchangeably, and we see that in various regulations or guidance, some of these terms are defined, and then we also have just jargon in the industry. And so over time, some of these terms start to get confused, and we confuse even terms that are as simple as, like, what is the plan document or plan documents? So you know, I want to just start with really going back to the basics. So even for those who are really proficient with retirement plans, I hope you'll kind of stick with us here through the beginning, because I think we'll even have some things that might be important to those who are really more proficient with plan documents as we talk through what I would consider the basics, but still some really important things. So let's start with, you know, just, is a plan document required? And so we're going back to the really basic concept of ERISA Section 402. So we know that under ERISA Section 402, every employee benefit plan shall be established and maintained pursuant to a, quote, written instrument. And such instrument shall provide for one or more named fiduciaries who jointly or severally shall have authority to control and manage the operation and administration of the plan. So this concept of the written instrument, that's where we get the requirement that we must have a plan document. The written instrument is our plan document requirement coming from ERISA. And the plan document, as I was just reading from the text of ERISA Section 402, the plan document has to name at least one fiduciary. So the one fiduciary a lot of times is like the employer name, for example, or the institution name. So that's where we get just our foundational concept here that the plan has to have a plan document. So one of the things that you might want to keep in mind is sometimes I think you may hear the term plan documents with an S. And when you're hearing plan documents with an S, what you want to keep in mind is that what we're going to talk about today is the plan document that's required under ERISA, but the other documents where the S is coming from, like the charter, the IPS, or when I say IPS, investment policy statement, or perhaps some of the many other policies that are adopted by the plan, those other policies like the charter and IPS, those aren't actually required by ERISA. Those are just other things that are really just fiduciary best practices, and those are going to be beyond the scope of what we're going to talk about today. So keeping in mind that once you adopt those are actually becoming documents of the plan, so that's where this term probably you hear documents with an S comes from. But there's some other great audio casts out there, some of which Summer has done with another colleague that talk about these other documents. But today what we're going to really focus on is the plan document that's required under ERISA Section 402. So then the question comes, you know, where do you get this plan document? Where, you know, if you're a plan, where is this plan document coming from? Well, the good news is you have options. Plans have options. So whether you're a plan sponsor or you're a service provider or an advisor who's working with the plan, you can help think through what are the options for where this plan document comes from. So in the plans that I'm working with, and, you know, I might let Summer kind of help me on this one and weigh in on what she's seeing as well, but the plans that I'm working with, I see it pretty well split, almost, I would say, maybe not quite 50-50, but almost. It's between two. So you can either have an attorney-drafted document, so like a custom document, or you could have a pre-approved plan document, which comes from a provider. And when I say provider, I mean a vendor like a record keeper or a TPA that's going to be providing that document to the plan. So we could do an entirely separate audio cast or webinar on just that topic alone. But I just wanted to give kind of a brief lay of the land on the difference between you could have an attorney-drafted document or you could have a pre-approved document that you're getting from a vendor. If you had an attorney-drafted document, you know, there's obviously pros and cons to each. The attorney-drafted document is going to typically be a single document. It's going to be really specific to the plan, which is really helpful if you have some complex issues with the plan. And it's also going to be really portable. The other alternative would be a document that's going to be coming from a provider. So often you would have like a volume submitter document, for example. So you'd have a specimen document that would offer these choices over the terms. And it may also have an adoption agreement that would contain elective provisions. So that would, when I say adoption agreement, most of you would be familiar with a lot of the check the boxes, and you go through and check which ones apply to your plan. So with the document that's coming from the provider, oftentimes one of the challenges I see with some of the plans I'm working with, there becomes somewhat of a document exercise in that there can be multiple attachments. So that can just be kind of a paperwork exercise. Sometimes you're trying to fit into a box where you feel like you might not totally fit. But typically there's a lower cost because it can be included in the record keeper, the provider's fees, if you're getting that document from the record keeper. And the administration is typically better coordinated with your vendor. So that's kind of just some high-level pros and cons or thoughts on those two document sources. Summer, I don't know if you have kind of additional thoughts or comments on that.
Yeah, just a couple comments. I mean, and I think Bonnie put it correctly that, you know, there's pluses and minuses on both sides. On the attorney drafted, sometimes we refer to that as an individually designed plan because on that front you have a little more flexibility to design the plan. Obviously within the IRS qualification requirements, you have flexibility to design the plan the way you want it to be and flexibility to amend the plan the way you want to, consistent with legal requirements. On the other hand, the vendor-type document, you don't always have as much flexibility because, like Bonnie said, you're checking the boxes on the adoption agreement for your various different choices for the different provisions. One thing to keep in mind on the adoption agreement side is on the vendor side, there's really kind of two components that make up that plan. As Bonnie said, there's the adoption agreement where you're selecting kind of the different options for will you have a match? If you have a match, what will it be? Are you matching on a payroll period basis or an annual basis, et cetera? But then there's also a base plan document, which kind of just has the boilerplate provisions that are going to apply to all the plans, essentially regardless of which options you're selecting. And so it's important to realize that those two combined make up the plan document. So often I will talk to a client and I ask them for a copy of the plan document and they send one or the other, not realizing that you really need both pieces of those to make up the plan document. Another issue that just kind of keep in mind is with respect to the changes we've had with respect to determination letters. So as most of you probably know, for many years we had a determination letter program where on a rolling cycle basis, about every 5 years, you would submit your plan, if you're an individually designed plan, for a determination letter. On the other hand, on the vendor side, you would rely upon the determination letter that the vendor plan had obtained. Well, now the IRS is, at least at this point, no longer doing determination letters as part of that rolling cycle. So you generally can only get a determination letter on when you initially create the plan or when you're terminating the plan, which creates this kind of weird gap where if you were on a vendor like a prototype plan and you want to switch to individually designed, you can't really get a determination letter on that individually designed plan. Or on the flip side, if you are on a vendor plan and you want to make some changes that to that plan that kind of take you outside of what the plan had intended when they got their determination letter, you may not be able to rely upon that determination letter. And so we're still in this kind of weird period where it kind of remains to be seen how that's going to be handled and what the best way to address that determination letter issue is.
That's a really good point. And Summer, could you briefly just go over what's the benefit of, you know, having the determination letter? I think that's come up with some of my plans recently, just as those rules have changed.
Yeah, and part of that I think is changing as well. I mean, traditionally, you know, you've never been required to get a determination letter, but traditionally plan sponsors have done that and obtained it because it gives them some comfort that their plan document at least complies with the IRS qualification requirements. That's no guarantee that you're administering things properly, and we'll be kind of getting into those later in the call, but it will at least give you comfort that your plan meets the documentation requirements. And typically, you would see those requested like in the acquisition context. So when a company is acquiring another company and as part of that acquiring its 401k plan, it's common to ask for that determination letter. So when you're acquiring that company, you've got some comfort that plan document is qualified. Also, it can help if you were audited by the IRS and they're raising an issue, well, you've got a determination letter that provision was okay. It also used to be required in order to take advantage of the IRS correction procedures that we'll chat about a little bit later, the EPCRS correction procedures. It used to be that you were required to have a determination letter in order to take advantage of those, but I believe they have gotten rid of that requirement because of this change in sort of the determination letter practice.
Perfect. Thank you. Anything else on there, or should we kind of transition into our next topic?
Why don't we keep moving on? I think that covers it.
Perfect. So I think, you know, the next thing we wanted to move on to, you know, now that we've kind of talked about what are the requirements to have a plan document, where would you get a plan document, I think the next thing that we really wanted to cover today are just what are the fiduciary responsibilities related to the plan document. And I think, you know, from my perspective, again, this may seem pretty basic, but one of the things that we just wanted to kind of do a reminder on is, you know, when we look at what I call kind of the five, you know, pillars of fiduciary responsibility. One of those five pillars is following the plan documents unless inconsistent with ERISA. So one of the things I do a lot with the plans that I work with is I always point them to or try to point them to the DOL piece, meeting your fiduciary responsibilities. So, you know, if you're sitting at a computer, I would encourage you to just Google meeting your fiduciary responsibilities. It's a DOL piece that's been around for a long time. I think they recently updated it again in 2017, but it's got a lot of just great information in it. One of the things it goes over is, you know, the five things you've got to do from a fiduciary responsibility perspective, you know, acting solely in the interest of plan participants, carrying out duties prudently, diversifying plan investments, paying only reasonable plan expenses, and then the key one for today's discussion, which is following plan documents. Another thing that guide talks about is that it goes over that each plan has certain key elements. And one of the key elements it points out is that a written plan, it says that a key element of having a plan is that there must be a written plan, that being your plan document, that describes the benefit structure and guides the day-to-day operations. And that really resonated with me because I think what that means is that your plan document should really be your guiding document for day-to-day operations. So when you think about fiduciary responsibilities, it's relating back to the plan document and using that as your guide for how to run the plan on a day-to-day basis. One of the things that I see with a lot of the plans that I'm working with is that they don't necessarily use the plan document to guide their day-to-day operations, even though it should really be that day-to-day guide. Instead, the plan document gets buried in a folder or a binder or somewhere on your hard drive that when someone comes and asks, hey, can I see your plan document? It's like the point that Summer made earlier, which is, you know, hey, where's your plan document? And you might get one or two attachments of the five that actually comprise the entire plan document. So I think, you know, for me, it's important to help plan sponsors, or if you are a plan sponsor, really think about using the plan document as your actual guide for your day-to-day operations. You know, Summer, I don't know if you have
any... That's a really good point. So often I will have a client call and say, hey, can we do this with the 401k plan? Or how is the benefit calculated in this circumstance? And my first question is obviously, well, let's see the plan document. What does that say? And that's another one where, you know, we talked about you need the adoption agreement and the base plan document if it's a vendor plan, or you need the document if it's an individually designed plan. That's one document. But don't forget amendments. And I know Bonnie was going to talk a little bit about when you amend the plan. But anytime you're making amendments, those amendments are part of the plan as well. And so if you're looking at a question, you need to take into account both the plan document and amendments. For that reason, what we will often do, because it can get really cumbersome to look at a plan document and then check all the various different amendments, oftentimes we will create what I call a working copy, which is the plan executed restatement, and then we will incorporate all the different amendments into that one document, so you can look at one document to answer your question rather than flipping back and forth between all the various different amendments. So didn't want to interrupt, but just thought I'd make that point clear.
No, so a great point on having kind of the working copy, because I think that's where I see a lot of issues come up with some of the plans I'm working with, is that they forget about the amendments, and so then they're, you know, maybe they made a change to eligibility, but maybe the HR person who is managing all of those documents has since left, and now the new HR manager comes in, but they don't know about the folder on the hard drive that had all the amendments in it, which was a different folder than the actual plan document folder. So now we're not administering to the amendments, we're administering to the main folder. So you see how there can become these incongruities or misalignment with the plan document because of amendments. So, and that's a perfect segue to kind of the next topic that we wanted to make sure we covered, which was, you know, we have this plan document, we have it in place, but over time, how does your document change? And it changes through amendments, but we wanted to make a few quick points on what happens when you make amendments, or how do you make amendments, and just a couple of key kind of tips or takeaways to keep in mind with respect to amendments. You know, amendments, there's a few things to keep in mind, one being they should be through a formal process and there should be documentation around the decision-making process to make the amendment. So, for example, if you had an amendment that was related to a fiduciary decision, and when I say fiduciary decision, that would be as opposed to a settlor decision, but if it's a fiduciary decision that's taking place in the committee, that would be something where the committee meeting minutes should reflect the facts and the decision-making process around that amendment, and then, you know, there's got to be some sort of actual amendment that's being made. So when there is an amendment, keeping in mind just some, you know, pretty simple tips, but things like make sure it's dated, make sure it's signed, make sure then once you have these amendments in place that they go to the parties who are working with the plan. So, for example, your record keeper or your TPA, those parties would need to make sure that they have copies of the amendments. And then make sure, of course, you retain a copy for your own records. So I think, you know, those four just operational steps are really key because over time when you're making these amendments, that's how you can end up with being out of line with your plan document. Another
right.
just
and along those lines, Bonnie, so I guess a couple things just to throw in my two cents worth. You know, when you're adopting an amendment to the plan, that's going to be a settlor decision that it needs to be done, and you don't necessarily have the same fiduciary responsibilities when you're amending the terms of the plan as opposed to when the committee is making fiduciary determinations. But another thing to think about is who has that authority. Typically, if you've got an employer, they adopt a plan, then that means the board has authority because the board acts for the employer, so the board has the authority to adopt that plan and make amendments. But oftentimes in the plan context, changes need to be made or desired to be made that don't always need to go to the board. Sometimes they are legally required or sometimes they're not going to have a material cost. And so oftentimes what I will see is rather than having to go back to the board every time you want to amend the plan, the board may either delegate that, you know, full amendment authority to the committee or to somebody else, and that's fine. Or sometimes what they will do is delegate amendment authority with respect to either legally required amendments or amendments that won't result in a significant cost to the company, and delegate that amendment authority to the committee or HR or somebody along those lines. And that can be done through resolutions, though what I typically prefer is to actually see that spelled out in the plan document, because if you actually put that amendment authority in the plan document, then when it comes time to amend the plan, you can go look at the plan document and say, okay, this is who has the authority to amend the plan, and so this is, you know, we're going to prepare resolutions for the committee that they can adopt in minutes approving that amendment and get the amendment executed. Whereas if you've just done the delegation through resolution, you've got to kind of go back and dig through prior resolutions and minutes to figure out and confirm who has that authority. So it certainly can be done either way, but my general preference is to actually fill out in the plan document who has amendment authority when it's been delegated away.
That's a really good point. I'm glad you brought that up. I guess another question, what would you think of doing that in a committee charter? Or if it wasn't spelled out in the plan document, what would be your thoughts in spelling out that authority through some sort of a committee charter or committee delegation of authority document? Would that work as well?
I think that would work as well, again, making sure you've kind of gone through the proper process. So if you start out with the board has this amendment authority and they're going to delegate it to the committee, and you're going to have that reflected in the committee charter, then I would recommend that the board then is the one who's adopting that committee charter, so they're essentially delegating through that committee charter some amendment authority to the committee.
Perfect. Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. So I think, you know, the thing we really wanted to touch on there is just making sure that, you know, amendments are done the right way, keeping in mind settlor versus fiduciary when you're making these decisions and how to report those back, and, of course, making sure those get documented. And anything else we wanted to kind of touch on there? One other just kind of tip for amendments that I think, you know, we've seen come up before is just making sure that we keep in mind that some plan amendments, some could be made any time, but some amendments, there's some timing issues around only making those in conjunction with the start of the plan year. So I think that's another thing to just keep in mind when you're going to make plan amendments is the timing of them.
No, that's an excellent point, Bonnie, and I see that come up a lot, which kind of drives home. I know Bonnie mentioned earlier you need to make sure if you're actually adopting an amendment that amendment is signed and dated. Oftentimes you see the amendments and they're not dated, and because there are requirements as to when an amendment gets executed, that date is actually very relevant, and I have had the IRS in various circumstances really question and push back and raise concerns if the document is not appropriately executed. And so, you know, there are many changes that can be adopted, and if they are generally discretionary amendments, oftentimes you can adopt the actual amendment by the last day of the plan year, as long as you've been, and have it retro to earlier in the year, as long as you were following it, actually doing things in accordance with that amendment. But there are some times where an amendment needs to be prospective, especially if it's something that might be viewed as a takeaway or taking away a benefit. And then another issue to keep in mind, and I see people miss this all the time, is if there's a safe harbor plan, So if you have a safe harbor plan, the general rule is that, as Bonnie said, you have to adopt the amendment before the beginning of the plan year. And part of that is because you need to include the information in the safe harbor notice that goes out before the plan year. The IRS has fairly recently relaxed that a bit, so you have a little more flexibility in that. But before you adopt any sort of amendment to a safe harbor plan mid-year, it's really important that you take a look at that guidance and make sure that it is actually something that you can change mid-year, and that if you're doing it mid-year, you're meeting the notice and other requirements in accordance with that IRS guidance.
Perfect. Those are, I think, really helpful tips for folks to keep in mind when they're, if they're a plan sponsor making their own changes, or if they're, a provider or an advisor or consultant working with plans. That's really great, important information. Summer, if it's okay with you, do you think I wanted to move on to maybe one other kind of topic area before we get into what I think folks will really, really be interested in, which are kind of the common problem areas. But before we jump to that, wanted to touch on a couple of things that I think cause some operational heartburn for some plan sponsors, which are just, how do participants get this information in terms of what's in the plan document? So briefly touching on the SPD, or rather summary plan description, the SMM, and the big question, do participants get a copy of the plan document? So really briefly, do participants get a copy of the plan document? No, you don't have a duty to just send out plan documents to participants. That being said, participants do have a right, if they request a copy of the plan document, to obtain a copy of the plan document, but you don't affirmatively have to just start mailing out copies of the plan document.
That's right. One thing to keep in mind is if it's actually requested, you're supposed to provide that plan document within 30 days, and if you don't, then you can start racking up penalties. I believe it's $110 a day if you don't provide that. Oftentimes this comes up, especially in kind of pre-litigation context. We live in this world where there's so much 401k fee litigation going on, and many times what we've seen is the precursor to that is the law firm gets their hands on a participant or beneficiary who wants and has them request the plan document, and usually they'll ask for a whole laundry list of documents, some of which need to be provided, some of which you may not need to. But if you get one of those requests, you really want to take it seriously and look at what you need to be providing, and make sure you're providing that promptly so that you don't start incurring those penalties.
And quick point on that, Summer. How do you recommend when a plan sponsor provides that documentation? Do you suggest that they keep some sort of a log of, the fact that they provided it within X number of days and who they provided it to, or how do you make recommendations around that?
Yes, I think that would make sense because, again, because there are penalties that can apply if you don't provide it in time, I would certainly want to document that was requested, when it was requested, and when you provided it. I don't think it necessarily needs to be anything formal, but keeping something so that you have a record of it, that you've responded appropriately, makes sense.
Perfect. So that's with respect to the plan document. The document that you do have to affirmatively send out to participants would be the summary plan description. So the summary plan description, that's your basic ERISA disclosure document that must accurately summarize the plan, and it's supposed to do so in a way that's in plain English so that participants can actually understand. So, the plan document's supposed to be a little bit more of the legalese, whereas the SPD, or the summary plan description, is supposed to be more of that plain English version. And that's what you do have to send out automatically to participants within 90 days of being covered by the plan. And then you also have to send that out upon request. And then once, I believe, Summer, correct me if this is wrong, but it's once every 10 years or once every 5 years if there's been a change to the plan. So I just always say once every 5 years because there's always a change to the plan once every 5 years.
Yeah, I know, I think that's right. But and then in the interim, if there are changes made to the plan, then you would be required to provide out what's called an SMM, or Summary of Material Modifications, that explains and summarizes those changes and includes some language indicating that that should be kept with the SPD. So essentially, somewhat similar to, you know, you've got a plan document that then has amendments. You need to look view the plan document and all those amendments together as one on the SPD if you are making changes. If you're amending the plan, then you're going to make changes to the SPD, and those can be done either through doing a new SPD, which can sometimes be a cumbersome process if you're only making a few changes, or you can do a separate, you know, one pager that's an SMM that describes the change to an existing provision of the SPD.
Perfect. And one of the things I would note is that a lot of this information that we just covered in terms of all of these, you know, we went over a bunch of times for sending out documents and what has to go when and where. This same type of information is covered. The DOL has a lot of this online. They have some really helpful guides. So, for example, they have a webinar that's available. You don't have to attend the webinar. You can just go online and get the slides from the webinar. So, for example, they have one, Getting It Right, Know Your Fiduciary Responsibilities, and it goes over all of this information and much more that we just covered, but really simple slides, really laid out in actually plain English. So I would encourage you, you know, if you're trying to work with a plan sponsor or if you are a plan sponsor, some great slides to have in your back pocket as a good reference to just go for more information on the types of information we just covered. So with that, I think maybe we've covered really all the basics related to the plan document. I think I'll kind of turn it to Summer to start to go through, you know, what she's seeing when working with plans as they work through some of the issues that pop up when you're actually going through the day-to-day of the plan document.
Great. Thanks, Bonnie. So, you know, there's a lot of various different issues that can pop up with administering a plan. Some of them are more common than others, and so I was going to talk about a few of those issues we've seen pop up. One is with respect to the definition of compensation. This is a really vital piece of the plan document that I think oftentimes people overlook, especially as there's been like a change in benefits administration or change in payroll or process. But the definition of compensation is key, because when you've got a 401k plan and somebody is deferring some of their income or there's a match, that deferral is based off of compensation, quote unquote, as defined in the plan. And there are various different definitions that plans may use. The most common that we see is W-2 comp, but oftentimes there are specific exclusions. A company might exclude bonuses, or they might exclude various different types of compensation. And if that's not communicated, especially kind of coordinating with payroll as to how things are flagged, it's really easy to either include something in compensation that shouldn't be or exclude it, which then is going to affect how much somebody deferred and can result in a plan error. Most recently, an issue that I've been trying to warn clients about and they need to think about is with respect to some changes as a result of the Tax Act that took effect this year. And so part of the Tax Act changes provide that certain moving expenses that used to be excluded from an employee's W-2 income are now included. The same with certain bicycle commuting expenses. And so what needs to be done is really to make sure that if that needs to be coded differently, that you are looking at that and coordinating that with payroll. So for example, if you have a compensation definition that's W-2 comp and you don't have any exclusions, well, last year, if somebody got qualified moving expenses, those moving expenses were not considered W-2 income and they would not have been included in compensation for purposes of making the deferrals. This year, those same moving expenses would be included in W-2, which would mean that they would be counted for purposes of an employee's deferral. And so I've been recommending that people coordinate and talk to payroll, because it's very possible that the payroll may have that moving expense coded so that it's excluded from 401k, whereas now it should be included because it's part of W-2. And so there's no one right answer necessarily. It's a matter of making sure that you have looked at your plan document and you understand what should be included in compensation versus what should not, because that can affect both deferrals as well as matching contributions or other employer contributions.
And Summer,
Go on.
I just wanted to reiterate the point that you made. You mentioned, you know, talking to payroll, because I think that's a really key point that on especially compensation, but on other areas of the plan document errors and trying to prevent the errors, it's making sure that you end up with the right players, just even within the organization, at the table to have the conversation. So it's not just the one person who's saying, oh, yes, this is our intention with respect to what we should be doing, but it's getting all the right folks in the room to make sure that, you know, payroll is doing what HR believes they should be doing and what finance believes that they should be doing, and having that joint conversation, and then also bringing in, you know, either the TPA or the record keeper or vendor to make sure that everyone's on the same page with how that should be working.
Exactly, and it's all in connection in following the terms of the plan document, especially if, you know, people all the time are adding new different payroll codes, and you've got to get all those people, like you just mentioned, on board with, based on the terms of the plan document, whether that should be coded as 401k eligible compensation or not. Another issue that comes up a lot is who is included and who's excluded from the plan. So oftentimes there are acquisitions, and so you're acquiring a new subsidiary. Well, you may have that subsidiary be a participating employer in the plan, or you may not. And so there's different ways to structure your plan document to address those, especially if you're doing them on a regular basis. I have had some clients who say that they want everybody to be participating in the 401k plan, and so they provide that these new subsidiaries automatically become participating employers in the plan, whereas others want to kind of do it on a haphazard basis and decide whether or not that particular group will be participating. Obviously, you still have to comply with discrimination issues, and I'm putting that aside for now. But you really want to think about your plan document and whether that's automatic or not, because if it's not automatic and you're acquiring somebody, you're going to need to amend that plan document or have them adopt a participating employer agreement, depending on how the plan is set up, before that participation starts so that you're properly addressing it. On the other hand, if you've got it set up so that people are, subsidiaries are automatically participating and you have some one-off situation where you don't, you need to make sure, where you're not going to want them to participate, you need to make sure that you're amending the plan beforehand to exclude them. So that does come up a lot, and it's important to understand how the plan is set up to address those types of situations. You also have situations a lot of times where a plan may exclude temporary employees. Well, there you really want to think about how those temporary employees are defined, because if they're defined based on hours of service or a time-based definition, then under the IRS requirements, if those employees end up hitting 1,000 hours, you need to make sure that they are offered eligibility and that they can go into the plan, because you can't just exclude somebody and have them work 1,000 hours or more and not participate. On the other hand, you could have a definition that's not hours-based, and you could exclude them even if they end up working 1,000 hours. So it's another one where you want to understand the terms of the plan and who is included and who is excluded. Vesting is a common issue in plan documents as to making sure that you are properly crediting service. One issue in particular on vesting that I've seen occur is if you have employees who move within the controlled group. So they may move from one employer who has a 401k plan to another entity that's part of the same controlled group as the main employer, but is not a participating employer in the plan. And people will then stop crediting service and stop giving them vesting service, and you're not allowed to do that. So if somebody is moving, even if they're moving to an employer in the controls group that's not participating in the 401k plan, you still need to make sure that you are giving them vesting credit with respect to the amounts that they may already have in their plan. And so that's another issue that comes up on a somewhat often basis.
And Summer, this will make you more.
Pardon me?
This one may seem more basic, but one of the things that I have come up with some plans I work with is just making sure when you're looking at, crediting to employees, but the difference is just between, eligibility and vesting, and making sure we understand the differences when we start to look at, how crediting towards eligibility and crediting towards vesting, and making sure we just understand the basic definitions of what these different things are. That seems to be an issue that comes up with some plans, just understanding all the different sections of the document and the various definitions.
Yep, no, that's a good point. I agree. Loans and hardships are another area where you see problems. You are not required as a plan to offer the ability for employees to take loans from their 401k balances or for them to be able to take hardships, but it's a pretty common procedure, and I think I have our policy, and I have more plans that allow for these probably than don't, but there's a lot of administration that goes along with those two abilities, and you want to make sure that the plan document is designed to allow for that, and that from an administrative standpoint, you're following their requirements. A few issues in particular that we've seen come up are on the loan context. Generally, a loan, the maximum period for a loan is 5 years, but there is the ability to have it for up to 30 years if it's in connection with the purchase of a principal residence. And one thing we've had the IRS question before, and they take a pretty strong view of this, is that if you are going to allow the 30-year loan, then there must be some sort of evidence, like the escrow agreement or purchase agreement or something, to prove that the loan was, in fact, being made in connection with the purchase of a principal residence to justify that 30-year loan as opposed to the 5-year loan. And keep in mind that even if you have kind of delegated the responsibility for administering loans and hardships to a TPA or record keeper or some third party, the plan sponsor or plan administrator still has the responsibility to make sure that the proper documentation is being kept and that those loans and hardships are being administered in accordance with the plan and the IRS requirements. You can't just kind of say, well, I just assign that to somebody else and it's their responsibility. It still ultimately is your responsibility. So keep that in mind.
And I think some of that, this is a place where we're seeing a lot of questions come up with some of our plans and confusion as to what they have delegated to their record keeper and what responsibility they still maintain as it pertains to both loans and hardships. So I can't stress enough that communication and understanding of your agreement with your vendor are just critical here as it relates to loans and hardships. Because I had an example come up recently where a plan thought that the record keeper was doing the hardship administration and vice versa. Ultimately, it was the plan sponsor's responsibility, of course, and so then there was some confusion and it really ended up resulting in a correction having to be done. So communication is key there, and making sure that what the record keeper has in their system matches the plan document and that matches how the plan sponsor is administering. So those three components all have to match.
That's a really good point. Another issue that comes up on the hardship front is, at least currently under the hardship safe harbor provisions, if somebody is going to take a hardship, then they are supposed to have their deferrals suspended for 6 months. And this creates problems all the time on a couple fronts. One, for whatever reason, this was not communicated to payroll to make sure that the deferrals were cut off for that six-month period. Or another issue comes up is, okay, the 6 months has gone by. Does the plan provide that the deferrals automatically start back up, or does the employee have to re-elect to participate? And so you want to make sure that whatever the plan document says is how you are administering that, so that if somebody has been through the 6 months and it's supposed to start back automatically, that you are set up to actually start those deferrals automatically. Now, I will say some of these issues will likely be going away because under some tax law changes, we're going to be getting rid of that 6-month suspension for plan years beginning on or after 1/1/19. So that issue, you know, may go away as plans get amended and that those changes get implemented. But at least for now, that's currently an issue that does come up. And I've seen that happen more than once. I've also seen, you know, plans who have done hardship distributions only to find out that, a plan document doesn't actually allow for hardships. So that's just another example of why you want to make sure that anytime you're doing something, you're making sure that that the plan document actually reflects that practice and that intent. Some other common issues that we see that need to be corrected for are RMDs, required minimum distributions. That seems fairly straightforward, but you'd be surprised how often that gets overlooked or who's responsible for that isn't necessarily clear, and everybody's saying, I thought you were doing it. No, I thought you were doing it. No, I thought you were doing it, which drives Bonnie's communication comment home. But RMDs are an issue, and it's an issue that the IRS has been fairly focused on recently in making sure that plans really are making those distributions in accordance with the RMD rules. And I should pause for a second. I say RMD. I'm assuming most people understand that. I'm referring to the required minimum distributions, where generally distributions are supposed to begin to participants no later than the later of April 1 after they turn 7.5 or terminate employment. And so that is an issue to think about. There's also problems employers run into when they want to do the RMDs, but they can't locate the participants. And the IRS has come out with some guidance fairly recently regarding steps you should take as a plan administrator to try to find those individuals so that you have some justification if you have not actually made the RMD because you've gone through all those steps and you still can't find the individual. Forfeitures. Anytime you've got a plan that has a vesting formula and somebody leaves before they're vested, they may end up with forfeiture dollars. And this, I think, is overlooked all the time, but as a general rule, if the plan has forfeitures, those dollars are supposed to be used or to kind of offset expenses or to offset employer contributions or allocated to participants by the end of the year in which they are accrued. And so often people don't realize that, and you can end up with a couple different issues. One, if the plan document is not drafted broadly enough to allow any permitted use of the forfeitures, you may have people who use it for expenses, which is allowed unless the plan document says that forfeitures are going to be allocated back to other participants, in which case you've got a problem. So you want to, generally I recommend that plan documents be drafted broadly enough to allow for any permitted use. And then you also want to make sure that those forfeitures are actually being used and sort of spent down by the end of the plan year or at least shortly thereafter, because if you end up with a situation where you've got forfeitures that are just accruing year after year after year and you're not doing anything with it, the IRS does view that as a qualification issue because they think it needs to be, you can't have these unallocated accounts that just go on in the plan document. And so that is another issue that needs to be corrected if you have that situation. So those are a few of the correction issues that come up on a regular basis. You know, there are many more. My guess is there's not a plan out there that doesn't have some sort of mistake, whether they've realized it yet or not. They are complicated plans, and errors happen. So one question comes up with, well, what do you do? So if you find out or determine that you have had a administrative error and you failed to follow the terms of the plan that set out how you were supposed to handle compensation or vesting or loans or hardships or any of the issues we've been talking about, the IRS does have correction procedures that give you the opportunity to fix the problem. And a few things to keep in mind with the correction. You know, a lot of times people think, oh, well, we made a mistake as far as how we were calculating the match and people got more than they were supposed to. So the participants are better off, so you know, we're not going to worry about it.
Well, yes, that benefits the participants, but the IRS's view is that you are supposed to follow the terms of your plan. And if you don't, that is a potential qualification issue where the IRS can actually come in and disqualify your plan. So even if it's a mistake that benefited your participants, that doesn't get you off the hook. You're still supposed to correct that problem. There are different ways where you may correct the problem, but it is something that needs to be corrected, even if it benefits the participants. It may be that you have to take the money back out of a participant's account, or you may be able to go into the IRS and ask for approval to amend the plan retroactively to provide that benefit, but you still have to do something. So the IRS correction procedures, you'll hear the acronym EPCRS, Employee Plans Compliance Resolution System. That's it. I say EPCRS so often I forget what it actually stands for. But essentially is the program that the IRS has set out for correcting plans. You generally can either do self-correction or a voluntary correction. Self-correction is pretty much what it sounds like, where you fix the problem. You don't go into the IRS. You don't pay any other fees, but you do actually go through and you fix the problem. Voluntary correction is where you go into the IRS and you tell them what happened. You tell them how you propose to fix the plan. You pay a fee to the IRS for processing it. And then when they approve your correction, you make the correction, and there you go. There are different times as to when you can do self-correction versus voluntary correction. Generally, self-correction is allowed anytime the error is either insignificant or you are correcting it by the end of the second plan year after the year the error occurred. So, for example, if you had an error that occurred in 2016, you generally can use self-correction as long as you do the correction by the end of this year. There are a few exceptions to that. So, for example, I mentioned the situation where you've contributed too much to a participant's account. If you want to try to correct that via a retroactive plan amendment, that is one where you have to go into the IRS and get approval through a VCP before doing that, even if it is something that would benefit the participants.
You mentioned insignificant. There is an element of this that's kind of facts and circumstances, correct? So determining if something is an insignificant versus a significant error, there's some kind of loose guidelines, but there is still some element of facts and circumstances, correct, in determining like self-correction versus VCP. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right. There's a number of six or seven factors that the IRS has set out that you're supposed to look at those factors and based on the facts and circumstances determine whether it was an insignificant error. They look at how many people were affected, how many people relative to how many people could have been affected. They look at the dollar amount, including the dollar amount relative to the total size of the plan, various different, how long the error went on for, that sort of thing. But yes, you're absolutely right. It's a facts and circumstances.
And I think from my perspective when I'm working with plans, that's where I oftentimes feel comfortable. I can give a plan sponsor the information as to what these various options are, but that's when I like to recommend that they go to outside counsel to help them to evaluate their options and going with a self-correction versus a VCP, for example, because those are very, facts and circumstances specific.
Right, yeah. No, it definitely requires some analysis and thinking about that. One thing I will say, a lot of times people want to just not do anything, and I've always said, even if it costs you money to fix it, it's going to cost you less money than if the IRS finds the problem, and you've got to fix it because the IRS has raised it. So it's not always the easiest thing to do the correction, but in the end, it's much better than if the IRS discovers the problem and you have to fix it then.
Yeah, and the other quick point I wanted to make is that, sometimes when, for how these errors get discovered, they can be discovered through, the IRS knocks on your door and they show up and they find these things. Sometimes you can discover these errors through your own kind of self-audit. But a lot of times folks will think, well, I can rely on my auditor to catch all of these things. And obviously, and this would apply for plans that are over 100 participants, but the problem with just only relying solely on an auditor to catch everything is that we have to keep in mind that an auditor is only doing a sampling, correct? So, you know, I think it's a great opportunity for the audit to catch a lot of things in these plans. But as Summer made the point, these plans are very complicated. Probably all plans have at least one issue somewhere in them. But what we want to keep in mind is that you can't solely rely just on an auditor. You need to keep in mind that just the notion that, hey, my auditor will catch everything might not be the best opportunity. You might want to do some self-audit as well.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. In fact, I wrote an article not that long ago about kind of the things you need to be thinking about, and it's important that you actually select a good auditor, because you're right, they're not going to necessarily find everything, discover every problem, but the DOL has issued some guidance indicating that they've done some studies, and auditors who do not do the fewer plans that an auditor audits, the more likely there's a problem with their audit. And so it really can help if you get a qualified plan auditor who is proficient with plans and has a lot of plan experience, because while it might seem like a pain, if the auditor finds the problem, it's a lot better than the IRS auditor finding the problem, because that does give you the chance to pick it. So it's very helpful to get an auditor who knows what they're doing and can help you with that, even if, you know, there's never going to be the perfect solution with an auditor.
Perfect. Well, I think we're getting close to our time, and I feel like we could maybe talk about this really fun topic all day. Should we share like a couple of just kind of quick tips for best practices to conclude and then open it up for questions?
Sure, that sounds great.
So, you know, I think we've shared a lot of tips throughout. A couple of my just kind of quick tips, again, we've shared a lot of these throughout, would be, you know, one, try to keep your plan documents simple. I know there's reasons to make it complex, but the more complex and more complicated it gets, the more difficult it is to administer. So try to keep it simple. Two, I would say, look at the resources from the DOL and IRS that are available. There's some really great resources out there, and you can find them with quick Google searches. Also, I would just share communication, both internally and externally with those service providers that you've hired for the plan. So your payroll provider, your record keeper, your TPA, your outside counsel, your advisor or consultant. The more people that you can get in the room to communicate and make sure everyone understands the plan's provisions, the better off you'll be.
I think that's exactly right. I think you've got kind of the key components there of what we've been talking about and how important it is to make sure that you understand the plan documents and everybody's on the same page as far as what the plan provisions say.
Anything
else? Can we turn it over to questions?
Yes, and if you would like to ask a question, please signal by pressing star 1 on your telephone keypad. If you are using a speakerphone, please make sure your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach our equipment. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line is open. Again, that is star 1 if you would like to ask a question. And we'll move to our first caller. Your line is open.
Yeah, I was just wondering about the new restatement process for prototype and volume submitters, if you could talk about that a little bit.
As far as, I mean, they're still able to get determination letters. I'm not sure exactly what you mean. I mean, I know they're still issuing plans and they still are submitting. I forget what the timing is as far as when they're submitting their for determination letters still.
Okay, but what I guess I was looking at is for the new legislative update, you know, how the prototypes are just ending their cycles, and I'm just wondering about for the next cycle, will there be advisory and opinion letters for the volume submitters and the prototype, or will they just be considered all approved documents?
I believe we're still waiting for some guidance as far as the amendments for the legislative updates. Typically, the IRS will issue some model amendments, and we haven't seen those yet.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
And once again, that is star 1 if you would like to ask a question. We'll now move to our next caller.
Yeah, my question is that I occasionally see a situation where the plan has entry dates, the person satisfied the eligibility requirement, but they start deferring before their entry date, and that we discover that the next year the W-2 has already been issued, the participants already filed their taxes. It's kind of too late to undo a deferral from the prior year. What's the fix for that? I've never really had a really good answer for that one.
I believe, and I would have to double check this, but I believe there's actually a discussion about that in the IRS correction procedures, where if you are letting people in before the entry date, that may be one of the few situations where you can amend the plan retroactively without necessarily having to go through a VCP. But I'd have to double check that. So don't quote me on that, but that's at least that might be the possibility to take a look at those correction procedures, that might be the way to do it.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Well, we are at our 11 o'clock end. So, Bonnie, should we just call it at this point? Did you have any final remarks you wanted to add?
I think so. I think we would just, you know, thanks, Summer, again, for joining me today. Thank you, everyone, for your time. We really appreciate it. And I believe that, once again, this is recorded, so it will be available for anyone who missed any components during the call. But thanks again, and enjoy the rest of the day.
Great. Thanks, everyone. Nice working with you, Bonnie.
Absolutely. You too.
And once again, that does conclude today's conference, and we thank you all for your participation. You may now disconnect.